This is Christy, and we have merchandise. Go to howtolovelitpodcast.com and check out amazing t-shirts, mugs, stickers. If you love great quotes, we have some of our favorites. If you love silliness, check out our mascot, Brain Man. Go to howtolovelitpodcast.com, clip on the shop button, and find something for that person who needs to be reminded that we are fashion creatures but half made up. Mary Shelley said that.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Christy Shriver, and we're here to discuss books that have changed the world and have changed us.
And I'm Gary Shriver, and this is the How to Love Lit podcast. This is our last in our three-part series discussing Jon Krakauer's nonfiction journalistic narrative, Into the Wild. In episode one, we introduced the story itself and the influence it's had over the last 30-plus years. We talked through the first five chapters, putting forth the idea that the book is a piece of rhetoric as opposed to being a simple biography. Krakauer suggests that the forces that really impelled Chris McCandless to leave home and roam the West and then settle in a bus outside of Haley, Alaska, were not senseless rage or madness or impulse, but it was intentionality of purpose. A natural and even common, if naive, reckless desire for adventure, and most importantly, a pursuit of individuated truth. Last week, we discussed Krakauer's critics, of which there are many. He investigates and considers the multitudinous criticisms of Chris McCandless, many of them emotional but not irrational, and many of them made by Alaskans and people familiar with the land and the wildlife. And in the second part of the book, we read through chapter 13, he addresses many of those criticisms, and he refutes them, to use the correct rhetorical term, and he refutes those criticisms by comparing Chris to other people who have gone into the wild, and some that he considers crazy or impulsive, and others he considers thoughtful and intentional even. Krakauer builds this argument that McCandless belongs to the second group and not the first. For Jon Krakauer, Chris McCandless followed his dream. He was moved by great courage. He had some reckless innocence and the urgency of his desire. And, you know, today we will develop more fully just what that desire was as Krakauer concludes his book, talking about his own misadventures as a young man, as well as Chris's final days in Alaska.
You know, one arguable claim on which a lot of Krakauer's argument hinges is this idea that McCandless was not running away from something as much as he was keeping his whereabouts a secret from his parents, but he was running towards something, a new version of himself, a truthful understanding of his place on this planet. And the more he uncovered about himself and about the more that he understood about the world, he talks about being filled with joy. He describes feeling joy more than once, and in fact, even at the end of his life. You know, joy is a different feeling. It's not the same thing as an adrenaline rush, and it's a wonderful feeling because it connotes a certain peace, and it makes the reader happy when you read him talk like this, especially after we learn how dark and full of rage this young man was on that day when he left Atlanta. And keeping that in mind, you know, it allows us to see this book as positive, even though there's no question that it's definitely sad at the end. So let's talk about how Krakauer develops the ending. The first thing he does where we left off as he tells his own story. Again, he does this in part as a refutation of Chris' critics, who paint McCandless as this divergent. And one major accusation people have is that he's got some sort of weird death wish. And many have asked, why on earth would somebody go out into the wild with no map and no food and not a really reasonable plan as to how to survive? He must have just had a death wish. But to counter this, John Krakauer tells the story of when he went out into the wild of Alaska alone. And, you know, let me tell you, as far as craziness goes, Krakauer's story is far crazier than McCandless's. In fact, if I had just heard the two plans and then had to pick which one was the most likely to end in death, I would not have picked Chris's story at all. Gary, John Krakauer took incredibly insane risks. And not to say that Chris didn't. Obviously, Chris made lethal mistakes, but they were in different veins. Krakauer's trek into the wild wasn't just incredibly different. It feels to me like a person like me who doesn't have any Alaskan experience, that it was much more dangerous.
You know, Krakauer was raised even as a young child in the outdoors and was incredibly prepared in ways that Chris McCandless wasn't. In that sense, the two excursions are different, even though they are both Alaskan adventures. And, you know, what is similar, and I think what Krakauer wants us to compare, is a similar mindset, a similar personal problem, and a similar view as to what Alaska might help them find on a personal level. Krakauer sees a little of himself in Chris McCandless and tells us so. And in fact, the success of the book indicates that many people see a little of themselves in Chris McCandless.
Oh, I agree. So let's talk about that. As we compare Krakauer and McCandless, what are some important similarities that Krakauer chooses to highlight?
Sure. Well, the most obvious is their need to take chances. At the end of chapter 13, Krakauer recalls a moment shared by Billy McCandless, Chris's mother. Chris's body had been found. The McCandlesses had gone to Fairbanks. They had retrieved Chris's ashes and were back home. About a month later, Billy was sitting at her kitchen table looking through pictures and crying and confused. And her comment, as he recorded in his book, was, "I just don't understand why he had to take those kind of chances." This was something Krakauer very much understood, and he relates one of his many experiences with taking chances. Krakauer shares with us some early experiences and his motivation to rock climb. And he says, you know, the danger bathed the world in a halogen glow that caused everything, the sweep of the rock, the orange and yellow lichens, the texture of the clouds, to stand out in brilliant relief. Life thrummed at a higher pitch. The world was made real.
You know, I want to point out that when Krakauer goes rock climbing, he doesn't hike the way we do around here on clearly defined safe trails, maybe in the Smoky Mountains near Sevierville, Tennessee, or down the side of the Mississippi River here in Memphis. I mean, when this guy goes, he's hanging for dear life, literally by his fingers, over nothing but large vasts of rocky expanses beneath him.
Well, when Krakauer chose to climb the Devil's Thumb in Alaska alone at age 23, he was attempting something most seasoned climbers would not even do. The mountain rises 6,700 feet from its base at an angle of 67 degrees. It's the biggest rock face in North America, and because of the weather, it's arguably the most dangerous on the American continent. And many have literally died climbing it. And Krakauer chose to do this alone and with no radio.
You know, his mother was not pleased.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, that's one comparison with McCandless. They both wanted to do this thing that they needed to do alone. The contrasting danger of the physicalness of the experience is what makes, you know, McCandless going out a few days out of Healy with no map kind of look fairly tame. Krakauer was hanging from cliffs. McCandless was wading through rivers and fighting large quantities of mosquitoes. You know, to Krakauer's great credit, I do want to say that when he recounts his experience, he does so with incredible honesty and humility about his own struggles. I mean, there could be a way to write this that would come across as braggadocious, because honestly, there's something here to brag about. But he doesn't come across that way at all. In fact, he highlights the parts of his experience that make him look bad and maybe even a little stupid. I mean, of course, from a rhetorical perspective, that's what he wants to do. This is intentional. I mean, his purpose of including his own experience isn't to show how much better of a survivalist he is than Chris McCandless. He's trying to build credibility when he weighs in on Chris's experience. Krakauer, even with a lot more experience than Chris, experiences similar things and makes similar mistakes. I mean, Krakauer talks about feeling lost, about sobbing, about screaming obscenities at a plane after not being able to get the pilot's attention. He recounts the physical stress of stepping off a hanging glacier. I mean, he talks about the feelings of happiness. He calls it a trance-like concentration, the only thing keeping his raw knuckles and cramped thighs from giving out and plunging into the abyss, if that's your definition of happiness. But in a sense, you know, he is justifying why people do what they do while also showing that the struggle is real. There seems to be magical moments for people willing to take these kinds of chances for sure, but some of it terrifyingly horrible.
You know, you really don't end this chapter desiring to book a trip to Alaska, you know, for the opportunity to march up the devil's thumb. And he really isn't making it sound like something a normal person should be attempting to do. And I'm going to bet money that most people don't know that the mosquitoes in Alaska are terrible.
Well, I didn't before I read the book, but I totally agree. I do want to go to Alaska, but I'm going to pass on the whole devil's thumb experience. You know, when he describes his behaviors at age 23, he portrays himself as being totally reckless. And at one point on this specific climb, after 3 days being trapped by a storm, he, in his infinite wisdom, pulls out marijuana and smokes a joint. And this, of course, ultimately resulted in a fire, which he put out with his bare hands, burning himself in the process and his father's tent. I mean, the story is incredible in its own right, and it's worth sharing just for the sheer absurdity of it. But that's not why he shares it. Remember, nothing Krakauer includes in his book is gratuitous. It's a short book. He's building his argument. And the purpose for telling this particular story isn't to brag on his, you know, crazy former self. I mean, it's not to brag on his ability to get out of a pinch. There's no spirit of arrogance. He almost dies. And that's the spirit that pervades. He recounts the incident to illustrate a shared characteristic, and to argue that a young man not seeing himself as mortal isn't even all that unique. I want to quote Krakauer here. He says this: "I knew that people sometimes died climbing mountains, but at age of 23, personal mortality, the idea of my own death, was still largely outside my conceptual grasp. When I decamped from Boulder for Alaska, my head swimming with visions of glory and redemption on the devil's thumb, it didn't occur to me that I might be bound by the same cause and effect relationships that govern the actions of others."
You know, the narrator, a much older John Krakauer, can look back at his former self and see the risks he couldn't see as a young man with incredible clarity and honesty, but what he is saying is absolutely biologically true for just about every young male. You know, there's a plethora of neuroscience research that supports Krakauer's observation. You know, at the age Krakauer climbed the devil's thumb, I'm going to say his frontal lobe, which is the main part of the brain that we use to forecast future consequences, it might not have been that well developed. Okay. And he quite literally didn't conceive that he was subject to the laws of cause and effect that govern other people. I mean, it's common. Many young men's brains won't fully develop in this regard really until their mid-20s, if not later. And, you know, I think I've mentioned this before, but that's one reason why they can easily be recruited and retrained in the military or the NFL or other things for that matter. You know, Krakauer's main point is that Chris is not different than himself or the countless other young men who embark on adventures they may not be up for a decade later. I mean, it's natural. And, you know, and although both young Chris and young John are extreme versions and they did extreme things, they are not anomalies or freaks of nature by any stretch. And most certainly they did not have a death wish. In fact, it's far more likely when Chris McCandless writes his postcards from Alaska talking about going into the wild, he likely didn't even conceive of death as a possibility.
You know, I want to say that not only does neuroscience support that claim, but so does literature.
Oh, well, then that makes it legitimate then.
It's yes. I mean, it's so common. It's a genre. We mentioned the term Bildung's Roman during episode one, but I want to revisit it. It was coined by a German literature professor in 1820 to refer to a type of novel that narrates a young individual's story of self-discovery. We've all read them. We've watched them on TV. It's where the reader watches a hero grow up, the change from boy to man, if you want to use a gendered term. Although, obviously, the protagonist can be a woman. I mean, look at Jane Austen and Emma. But there are many aspects to growing up or coming of age, and usually they involve the protagonist proving himself within a society and the moral deficiencies that he sees in that society. I mean, we can think about Huck Finn and the racist society he encountered, or David Copperfield or the crimes against children during the Industrial Revolution, or Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye and Amir in The Kite Runner. I mean, these stories all involve a young man or a woman taking certain physical risks. I mean, there's a lot of literature that points to this restlessness that's inherent in youth. And I see it in my students. I mean, it's a natural dissatisfaction with the world as they see it. We call it the idealism of youth. And many of my students talk to me just about their need to feel like they need to get out of Memphis or Tennessee, or at least out of their house. I mean, for some, this journey is going to be an inward journey. That's like Emma. But often, travel is a motif. And in every case, and this is the point that I want to highlight because this is important, in all of these stories, the protagonist comes back from his travels and reintegrates into society as this new, different person, a more actualized person. I'm going to try to get psychological, if that's the right Maslowian term. Integrated. Gary, am I close?
Maslowian. Oh, okay. Well, I think you got it. And, you know, Krakauer argues very emphatically and gives a lot of evidence to support his claim that is exactly what Christmas Candlest intended to do. He intended to reintegrate into society. In fact, he made every effort to do so.
You know, and that's the tragedy of the whole thing.
It really is. You know, and another point of comparison beyond both these men being young who took risks, and this is in the line and with your coming of age idea, that both Krakauer and McCandless had to individuate from their fathers in order to fully participate as individuals in their own respective societies. And of course, again, they are not unique in this. I mean, every child has to individuate from their parents. That's what it means when we say grow up. Every child has to become their own person and separate from their parent, and it's never easy. You know, as little children, we naturally understand ourselves as extensions of our parents. But in both Krakauer and McCandless's case, this is made even more difficult because their fathers were difficult and their relationships with their fathers were difficult. In McCandless's case, he even had a false narrative so extremely different from the truth as to who he even was within the family that it took literal physical space for him to be successful. And McCandless had many legitimate reasons to be angry with his father, and he held himself to high expectations just like he held his father to high expectations. And many people have asked over the years why he could forgive moral failings in others but not in his father. And this, of course, that's a complex question. But the broader point is that McCandless was seeking to heal himself. And Krakauer's situation was not as extreme, but Krakauer is very honest that it took him into adulthood to accomplish this.
So let's revisit this for a second. And I don't want to go too far down this tangent, but let's theorize if we can. What do you mean by that term individuate?
Sure. And just to be clear, you know, these are the ideas of Carl Jung and the psychodynamic theory. And, you know, and teenagers can notice this in their own experiences. As you grow up, you begin to become more self-aware of your own identity, that your identity is not your parents. And we notice this in junior high when all of a sudden we feel a need for more privacy than we did as a smaller child. And we don't feel the need to tell our parents every single thing, especially we don't want to tell them about our romantic side. And a lot of times a young person will challenge their family's values or their culture's norms. I mean, if your dad is a businessman, you may choose to be a socialist and, you know, that sort of thing. all of this is normal and healthy. And if you are not able to go through this process for any number of reasons, that's when we get into a lot of problems. And we can feel anxiety and depression and low self-worth and low motivation. You know, there's a number of problems. But this is a normal situation. But Chris's situation wasn't normal because his family dynamic was abusive at several different levels.
So Krakauer and Michaelis are similar in these two very important ways. One is that they both push themselves physically to do dangerous, extremely dangerous things. Both struggled psychologically because of a difficult father-son relationship. You know, but in neither case did either one of them desire to self-destruct.
Well, they didn't, and I think that's it exactly. You know, there's one more important difference to consider. Krakauer felt a need to push the bounds of nature to the extreme. He pushed the outward limits of his body. McCandless's journey was much more internal. Although he did push his body, it was in a different way. It was really kind of more spiritual.
Yeah, and Krakauer doesn't mention hauling any books up Devil's Thumb, you know, the way that McCandless hauled books out into the wild. McCandless isn't proving the same point, I don't think, maybe that Krakauer was trying to prove. McCandless wants to see if he can live off the land. And honestly, he doesn't go all that far off the grid. And Krakauer highlights this. So back to how Krakauer frames his book, we see, you know, chapters 14 and 15, they're about Krakauer's experience as a young man in Alaska. Then he immediately juxtaposes that against Chris's experience in Alaska. Let's read about what Krakauer says about McCandless's hike, and then we can see the comparison.
A day later, as the trail crested a ridge, he got his first glimpse of Mount McKinley's high, blinding bulwarks. And a day after that, May 1st, some 20 miles down the trail from where he was dropped by Galleon, he stumbled upon the old bus beside the Shoshana River. It was outfitted with a bunk and a barrel stove, and previous visitors had left the improvised shelter stocked with matches, bug dope, and other essentials. Magic bus day, he wrote in his journal. He decided to lay over for a while in the vehicle and take advantage of its crude comforts.
You know, although McCandless did keep hiking, I mean, he went out another 15 miles before he turned around and decided to settle into the bus for the rest of the summer. But according to Krakauer, by Alaska standards, that's not all that remote. I mean, let's read how Krakauer describes this location where he ends up settling in. It's less than 30 miles to the east is a major thoroughfare, the George Parks Highway. Just 16 miles to the south, beyond an escarpment on the outer range, hundreds of tourists rumble daily into Denali Park over a road patrolled by the National Park Service. And unbeknownst to the aesthetic voyager, scattered within a six-mile radius of the bus are four cabins. None of them happened to be occupied during the summer of 1992. But despite the relative proximity of the bus to civilization, for all practical purposes, McCandless was cut off from the rest of the world. He would spend nearly 4 months in the bus, all told. And during that period, he didn't encounter another living soul. In the end, the Shoshana River site was sufficiently remote to cost him his life.
You know, the fact that it is at the bus that Chris's life will end is always present in the book.
Agreed. And you can't help thinking about it when he gets to the bus for the first time. I want to read Chris's note. It's the note they found when they discovered his dead body. Krakauer called it an exultant declaration of independence. 2 years he walks the earth. No phone, no pool, no pets, no cigarettes. Ultimate freedom. An extremist, an aesthetic voyager whose home is the road, escaped from Atlanta. Thou shalt not return, because the West is the best. And now, after two rambling years, comes the final and greatest adventure, the climactic battle to kill the false being within and victoriously conclude the spiritual revolution. 10 days and nights of freight trains and hitchhiking bring him to the great white north, no longer to be poisoned by civilization he flees. And walks alone upon the land to become lost in the wild. Alexander Supertramp, May 1992.
Of course, as we read it now, it's easy to see that Chris sounds like a child. He's not saying anything many young men and women haven't thought a thousand times over. And, you know, in F. Scott Fitzgerald's words from The Great Gatsby, these are, and I quote, "The intimate revelations of young men, or at least the terms in which they express them, are usually plagiaristic and marred by obvious suppressions."
Usually plagiaristic and marred by obvious suppressions. True. Although I will say, you know, Chris didn't pretend he was being original with any of his lines. I mean, he even has quotation marks around one phrase.
Of course he did. You know, and what's so interesting is how many different influences he channeled. That first line comes from a song that came out in 1964 by country artist Roger Miller. That song was titled King of the Road. It's very popular, and you'd likely recognize the melody if I sang it, but I won't subject you to that. But, you know, the song talks about the day-to-day life of a traveling hobo who, even though he has no money, he loves his freedom and calls himself King of the Road. And, you know, let me read the first verse and tell me if you recognize anything. "Trailers for sale or rent, rooms to let, 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. I ain't got no cigarettes."
I wondered, you know, when I read McCandless's, I didn't realize it was a song. And I said, why is he talking about pools? But he got it from the song.
Yes, he did. But the song isn't a dark song. I mean, it's cheerful, and it's in this vein that we see McCandless using it here. And McCandless is happy, and we talked about joy last episode, and I see it here too. This is an adventure of a lifetime. And, you know, these phrases, ultimate freedom, an extremist, an aesthetic voyager, I mean, that's a bit of fun in there. And this is the best of McCandless. But Roger Miller isn't the only artist that McCandless quotes. He also uses this line that is in quotation marks from "The West is the Best." This is a quote from Jim Morrison's song, "The End," from The Doors. This song is much more cryptic and difficult, especially since its author, Jim Morrison himself, is cryptic and difficult and died of a drug overdose. And in 1969, after the song was a smash hit, Morrison was interviewed in Rolling Stone magazine and asked what the song meant. And he said, "To tell you the truth, every time I hear that song, it means something else to me. I really don't know what I was trying to say. It just started out as a simple goodbye song."
Yeah, it's a little eerie. I want to read the lyrics of Morrison's songs where McCandless got it. "There's danger on the edge of town. Ride the king's highway, baby. Weird scenes inside the gold mine. Ride the highway west, baby. Ride the snake to the lake, the ancient lake, baby. The snake, he's long, 7 miles. Ride the snake, he's old and his skin is cold. The West is the best, the West is the best. Get here and we'll do the rest. The blue bus is calling us, the blue bus is calling us. Driver, where are you taking us?" You know, of course, McCandless quoted that song more than just in the note and well before Alaska. So, you know, I don't think he's intending it as a goodbye song at all.
Oh, you know, I totally agree. It's interesting, but I don't think either of the song lyrics are the most important part. It's that next phrase that really strikes me. He says this, "And now, after two rambling years, comes the final and greatest adventure, the climactic battle to kill the false being within and victoriously conclude the spiritual revolution." And to me, that's the whole book. Everything is summed up right there. And that was always his end game, to kill the false being within. I mean, it's a great way of expressing that process of individuation. And it's a noble goal. It's the right goal. And if we allow ourselves to speculate, you know, it's nice to believe that he did it. And in chapter 16, Krakauer provides sufficient evidence to show that McCandless, you know, maybe like Huck Finn and all those other heroes in those coming-of-age novels, was ready to return to society. I mean, he patched his jeans, he shaved, he organized his pack, he took a snapshot of himself grinning at the camera. On July 3rd, may I note, that's the day before America's Independence Day, he headed back to walk not into the wild, but into the world. Only this time, he discovered the unexpected. He discovered that he couldn't get back.
His journal expresses this, and I quote, "Disaster, reined in, river looks impossible, lonely, scared. For a journal that is pretty devoid of emotion, this is a big admission. McCandless was forced to return to the bus, but this time, however, He's not free. He's trapped. Michaelis's death has been a mystery all these years. Of course, we know he died of starvation, but we don't know why he died of starvation. He'd survived so long. Why couldn't he make it until those hunters showed up? When Krakauer first wrote his article, he believed Chris had accidentally poisoned himself with poisonous wild sweet peas. And in the book, Krakauer acknowledges his first theory was likely wrong. And in the book, he suggests that Michaelis died of wild potato seeds because they contained a toxic alkaloid. This explanation, however, obviously didn't completely convince Krakauer because he continued to investigate. And in 2007, 15 years later, and a lot of research later, Krakauer came to a different conclusion. This time he posited that Michaelis died not of toxic seeds, but of toxic mold that had grown on the seeds that he'd stored in a Ziploc bag. It's a plausible theory, but obviously not 100% conclusive because Krakauer in 2013 put forth the findings of a man by the name of Ronald Hamilton. And this man had evidence that maybe it was wild potatoes that Chris had eaten that poisoned him.
Man, I mean, you know, that's a lot of theories. Seeds, potatoes, mold.
Oh, I'm not done. In 2015, Dr. Jonathan Southard, Dr. Ying Long, Dr. Andrew Colbert, and Dr. Sri Thenadar present a paper in a peer-reviewed journal of medicine titled Presence of L-Canavinin in Hedrosarum alpinine seeds and its potential role in the death of Chris Michaelis. That sounds pretty scientific to me. But even that wasn't the final word. In 2016, a man by the name of Craig Medrid wrote a very critical article, really bordering mean. Listen to the title. The fiction that is John Krakauer's Into the Wild.
So he doesn't like Krakauer's death theories?
Oh, the article is much more than just the death theories. Among other things, Medrid believes that Chris got sick eating toxic mushrooms. He cites Michaelis's journal, which is interesting, that there are 89 of 113 entries that state many mushrooms dream. He also points out that there are many photos of mushrooms on film found on Michaelis's body, and the specific mushrooms in Michaelis's pictures are known to make people sick and hallucinate.
So is it Medrid's contention that Michaelis poisoned himself with mushrooms?
Well, ironically, it seems that the mushrooms in question make people sick, but they don't necessarily kill people. So maybe it was a factor. Medrid certainly believes Michaelis was trying to get high off of mushrooms, but was his health compromised enough for these mushrooms to kill him? I don't know how scientifically credible that argument is. I mean, I bring it up, though, just to point out there are so many theories out there. Nobody knows and likely will never know how Michaelis died. Maybe it was a mosquito. Maybe he had something else that he didn't write about. Maybe he got sick, caught a cold. I mean, how could anyone know? It's truly a mystery. Krakauer visited the bus himself, and he describes in the book his own experiences at the bus at the end of the book. He, along with the men who are traveling with him, are obviously moved when they get there. And what we come to understand in these last chapters is that this story, the one that we've been reading, isn't just about Chris Michaelis. This is about John's journey to understand Michaelis. And as Krakauer crosses the river and hikes with these three Alaskan guides, it's clear that they reflect a lot on Alaska, on what Chris was doing, on what they are doing as outdoormen in the great Alaskan wilderness. I mean, these men reflect on Chris's deliberate choice to refuse to use a topological map. Krakauer hypothesizes that Chris wanted to create a blank spot on the map because maps no longer have blank spots. And maybe that's true. Maybe it isn't. It's certainly a way to understand it. But they reflect on Chris's deliberate desire to not bring any proper supplies. Roman, one of Krakauer's guides, and this guy is renowned for his exploration, discusses this. I mean, he makes an important point.
And this is what Roman said. Sure, he screwed up, but I admired what he was trying to do. Living completely off the land like that month after month is incredibly difficult. I've never done it, and I'd bet you that very few, if any, of the people who call McCandless incompetent have ever done it either, not for more than a week or two. Living in the interior bush for an extended period, subsisting on nothing except what you hunt and gather, most people have no idea how hard that actually is, and McCandless almost pulled it off.
You know, Krakauer's critics claim that Krakauer has romanticized Chris, giving him too much credit when he was just a punk kid. I mean, they claim his journal is just a list of bad decisions. I mean, and there are bad decisions. He didn't bring enough supplies. He didn't research how to dress a moose properly, and he didn't pay attention to the river.
Well, true, but, you know, there's obviously more than that. Roman, the guide, seemed to identify with McCandless, and, you know, people make pilgrimages to the Stampede Trail, and what we can always understand is that if something appeals to broad swaths of people, especially over long periods of time, there is always something important that is resonating with the human experience and something more than romanticized identification. I mean, it is on us to understand what it is and not just dismiss it or large numbers of people as quacks for doing it.
Right. And McCandless, as we know, spent a lot of time reading. One of his favorite authors seems to have been the adventurous Jack London. And in many ways, these two men had a lot in common. I mean, London was a thrill seeker, no question. I mean, he explored the Northwest, among many other dangerous activities, many that could have killed him. London's famous, well, I will say this, London's most critically successful and probably most anthologized story is To Build a Fire. And that story is a hyperbolic tale about an unnamed man who, against the advice of an old-timer and the instincts of his guide dog, goes into the Klondike at minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit, poorly supplied with no good plan. In London's story, the man makes a rookie mistake, a small mistake, really. He builds a fire under a tree, and the tree heats up, causes the ice on the tree to melt, puts out the fire. The man can't restart the fire, and he freezes to death. It was a small mistake, but it was a deadly one.
Well, that's ironic, and I'm sure there have been no shortage of people willing to draw the parallels between McCandless and London's character.
I know, and most people can easily do that. I mean, it's obvious. We can all see the irony. However, I want to make a second comparison with the story, one that maybe is less obvious. London goes to a lot of trouble to point out that the man in his story walked through nature, saw all of it, but understood none of it. The man in London's story is shallow. He's so shallow, he's nameless. He's detached as a human. At one point, he thinks about, you know, killing his dog for wool. This man in London's story is totally unlikable, and when he dies, no one cares. Nature is indifferent, as we are, and we look at that man and say, good riddance. But we don't understand McCandless in the same way. McCandless may have had a spirit of arrogance in that he thought he could live off the land. Yes, he made rookie mistakes, maybe small ones, but they cost him his life. But none of that means that he didn't respect the land. I would argue that McCandless had the greatest respect for the land. He believed that that land could give him something he couldn't find anywhere else on planet Earth.
Exactly. And he thought that land could kill the beast within. And, you know, Jim Morrison was from an era in rock and roll where every artist was trying to, you know, journey to the center of their minds. And yeah, that was actually a phrase from that time period. And lots of them did this with psychedelic drugs, with their music, with their alternative lifestyles. And Krakauer claims, and I think he makes a strong case, that McCandless went into nature to explore the inner country of his own soul. And he found what he was looking for looking outward into the land. You know, and let me quote Krakauer as he talks about this in the second to last chapter of the book. An extended stay in a wilderness inevitably directs one's attention outward as much as inward, and it is impossible to live off the land without developing both a subtle understanding of and a strong emotional bond with that land and all it holds.
And so Krakauer ends his book with Michaelis's death. I mean, the reader watches without understanding why or how Michaelis starved to death. On August 5, Michaelis proudly records, day 100, made it, but in weakest condition of life. Death looms as a serious threat. Too weak to walk out, have literally become trapped in the wild. No game. On August 12, he leaves the bus to look for food, but he leaves a note. SOS, I need your help. I'm injured, near death, and too weak to hike out of here. I'm all alone. This is no joke. In the name of God, please remain to save me. I'm out collecting berries close by and shall return this evening. Thank you, Chris Michaelis.
And notice he signs with his own name. Alex is gone.
He does. And that to me, I mean, although this note is desperate and horrifying, demonstrates something. He's Chris again. It's the end of the building's roman. A young man has returned to society, even if he is trapped in the wild. He didn't want to die Alex Supertramp, and he didn't. The last thing Chris Michaelis wrote was on the back of a page from a Louis L'Amour novel titled Education of a Wandering Man. On the page that Chris wrote on, Louis L'Amour had quoted a poem titled Wise Men in Their Bad Hours. And the poem talks about death coming and what it means to be dying. On the other side of the page, written in Michaelis' hand, he writes his final thoughts. It's interesting. It's not a curse against his family. It's not a rage against the indifference of nature. It's not regret for a life that's cut short. Incredibly, it's a note of thanksgiving. This is what he says. I have had a happy life and thank the Lord. Goodbye. And may God bless all. He would not have said those words in high school, and I don't think he would have said those words driving out of Atlanta in that Datsun. I'm not sure he would have said those words to Jim Gallion the day Gallion dropped him off on the side of the road. But after 112 days, isolated in that Alaskan wild, he died with thanksgiving, not looking inward. He's looking outward. He's praying for God's blessing on the rest of us. This is a picture of redemption. I would argue he's being saved from the false being within. And it's what he wanted. It's what every person on this earth wants. And some would say, although no one wants it to cost them their lives, the pursuit of that goal is worth the risk.
Thank you for listening to our discussion of John Krakauer's book, Into the Wild. If you enjoyed this episode, check out our others. Whether you are listening on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, or any other podcast platform, don't forget, you can always find us at howtolovelitpodcast.com. On our website, we have listening guides for most of our episodes, as well as other teaching resources. And, you know, please subscribe to our podcast. And if you enjoy what we do, give us a rating. And if you have a minute, a review. It's when you share the podcast that we grow. And thank you for supporting us in our mission to make reading great literature accessible and enjoyable to as many people as possible.
Peace out.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.